All right, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I know there's still some people coming in, but that's all right. First of all, thank you all for coming. When I saw my time slot, I was just like, oh, Jesus. 9 a.m, the day after the party. Whoever scheduled this has never seen me at a conference party, clearly. But whatever, I'm here, you're here. I'm glad. I'm really happy to see this. I came in this room yesterday and was like, oh, dude, that's a big room. There's going to be like 6 people. So I'm glad. So the title of this talk, as you probably know, is Designer and Developer, a Case for the Hybrid. So my name is Jeff Croft. A little bit about me. I live in Seattle. I work primarily for a company called EngineWorks, which is a digital design agency based in Jacksonville, Florida. And I've been doing that for a couple of years, been working with them. I've also worked with other agencies. I've worked in journalism. I've worked in education. And you can find me at jcroft on Twitter is probably the best place to find me. This is the slide where I insult your intelligence by trying to make you believe that I'm really important and special so that you'll blindly accept anything I say without challenging it. I want to know a little bit about you. So how many people in here would identify themselves as designers? Okay, it's probably about half, maybe a little less than half, which is interesting. What about developers? Okay, more. Okay, how many of you guys would at least thought about raising your hand on both times? Yeah, okay, cool. Okay, well, then how about this? How many of you guys work in-house? Like you work for a company and you're working on their products? Most of you. So, and then the other percentage, I assume, are sort of client services. So you're working at an agency or working for clients. Yeah. Okay. How many of you are hungover? Yeah. How many of you are still drunk? Good. Those are my people. All right. So me, I'm a hybrid, and so my story. I started working on the web back in '94. And my title, I think, was the same as everybody's title then, which is webmaster, right? As you guys remember this, the webmaster was like the guy that looked a lot like Milton from Office Space that basically did everything related to the web, whether it was server administration or doing HTML or slicing up images, just whatever it took, whatever needed to happen. That was me. About late 90s, there started to be sort of a split where it was, I started to feel like there was some pressure in the industry to like choose. You're either going to be a designer or a developer. And I chose to be a designer. So I kind of went down that path for a while. And sort of in the mid-2000s, I was building a lot of sites for clients and whatever. And I was using a lot of sort of off-the-shelf tools like Movable Type. Do you guys remember Movable Type? It was like a blogging CMS and things like that, some things that I bought, some things that were free. I'd find little scripts online. There'd be like those sites. I don't think these still exist. Well, maybe they do still exist, but these little sites where you can just go, and I guess they're called GitHub now. But it used to just be these sites. It was like scriptkitties.com or whatever, and you would just download all the little JavaScripts and little PHP scripts. And I had no idea like what the hell any of it meant, but I'd be able to like just go in there and tweak a thing or two and get it to do what I wanted it to do. And I'd find myself really like trying to shoehorn things into Movable Type or some other platform that really didn't belong. So I like trying to build like an e-commerce site with this blogging platform, and it wasn't elegant. Sure there were e-commerce platforms, but I didn't know them, and even if I had known them, they had limitations too. So here's an example of this. I built this. Well, in 1999, I bought a Volkswagen New Beetle, a total girl car, I know. But I bought this New Beetle, and I loved it. And I was like, I'm going to build a website for New Beetle owners. This was like 2000 or something. And I built this site, and I built it on vBulletin. Have you heard of this? It's like a forum software, right? It sucks. It's terrible. It really doesn't suck, but it sucks if you're trying to make something other than a forum, which I was. This had a forum, but I wanted it to be more than that. And this is one of the first experiences where I was like, damn, maybe I need to like learn how to write code. I did HTML and CSS, but I thought, maybe I need to really learn how to like build my own stuff. I sold this site in 2004, and I just thought, you know, like I hadn't even thought about it for like 7 years, and then I was like, oh, that would be a good example for the presentation. And I went and I looked, and it, not only is it still alive, but that's my design from like 2003, and it's still on the same version of vBulletin is when I sold it. So anyway, that's interesting. So the bottom line is off-the-shelf tools suck. Well, at least they suck when you're trying to make them something they're not. And I, you know, obviously there are good ones, and there are plenty of uses for off-the-shelf tools, but I just found myself really frustrated a lot of times with the things that I was trying to do and just finding limitations. So in 2006, I got a new job. This was really the job that I think kind of propelled my career to the next level. It was at a newspaper company in Lawrence, Kansas, of all places. And any Kansas people in here? Yeah, awesome. Rock chalk, right? Yes. Okay. Sorry, this is a little bonding moment. So I was working for the newspaper in Lawrence, and but believe it or not, like this is a really innovative place where a lot of cool stuff was happening. There were some really brilliant programmers there, and I was really the only designer there. There was one other designer, but he was really more acting as a manager. And I was just really working alongside these guys that were just really brilliant. They were working on this thing called Django. Do you guys know this? Do you know what Django is? So Django is this. Is this web application framework for rapid development, sort of akin to like Ruby on Rails or .NET, you know, MVC sort of platform, but it's written in Python. And I had no idea. I mean, I didn't know what any of that meant. My job was just to be a designer. But these guys were really, really brilliant. I mean, Django now is, you know, used at Google, and it's, you know, so these guys really were like smart dudes, and it was awesome to be there. But I had no idea how to talk to them. And I mean, they were great, but I didn't speak their language. It was difficult for me to like get what I wanted out of them because I just didn't know how to sort of, I mean, really what I wanted to do was manipulate them into doing what I wanted them to do. But I couldn't do it very well. I really wanted to just be able to influence the entire product, but the way it was really working was that, you know, at some point they would go like, okay, that page is done, now you make it pretty. And that's just wasn't really what I wanted to do. And it made me realize that I'm kind of a control freak. Today I call it a product designer. But same thing, I think. And anyway, the point is I really just wanted to be involved in the entire project, not just the design aspect, especially not just the visual design aspect. I think that designers are by nature problem solvers, and I wanted to solve problems outside of just the visual. That was really the point when I was like, all right, I got to learn, you know, how to write some code. I was like, if for no other reason than just so I can tell these guys what I want and in a language that they understand and it will make sense to them and they might respect me or whatever. So I dove into Django and Python, although that's really not important. It doesn't matter what language, but that's just where I started. And it got to me really thinking about what I call the materials of the web. So let's talk a little bit about materials versus tools. In fact, let's talk about tools first. So tools are really important. Anybody that's going to be good at their job, especially in the design field, has to really know their tools. So, you know, a fashion designer really has got, you know, they've got to be great with scissors and sewing machine and needles. And an architect has got to be able to draw. He's got to, you know, maybe able to use some CAD software. And a web designer, you know, probably needs to know every keyboard and shortcut and probably needs to be able to use their Mac like a two-bit whore. But, it happens. Sorry. You know, these are all tools, and that's great. I mean, it really is important to know your tools. But ultimately, if you don't understand the materials that you're working with, you're not going to get very far with those tools. So, you know, in the case of the fashion designer, the materials are, you know, silk and leather and cotton, and architects, we're talking about steel and concrete and glass, and print design, we're talking about paper and ink and printing processes. And for a web designer, I mean, ultimately, your material is code. I mean, it really is. Like, that is the building blocks of everything on the web. It doesn't matter if it's HTML or CSS or Flash or Silverlight or Python or Ruby or .NET or whatever. It's all code. And you trying to build products without understanding code, or even trying to design products without understanding code, is a lot like an architect designing a building without understanding the inherent properties of steel. Like, that would suck. Or you're a fashion designer trying to design a dress in a material that she's never really played with or you know, experimented with. And if you don't believe me, then maybe you'll believe Jonathan Ive. You guys know who Jonathan Ive is? Jonathan Ive is the industrial designer pretty much responsible for every cool thing Apple has made over the last 10 years. iMac, iPod, iPhone, iPad, all that is his. He's credited with the design. So he says, it's very hard to learn about materials academically by reading about them or watching videos about them. The only way you truly understand a material is by making things with it. So you can't really argue with Jonathan Ive. And if you can, maybe you won't argue with this guy. This is Jeffrey Zeldman. Jeffrey Zeldman was, of course, sort of the godfather of web standards and really pivotal figure in our industry. And he says, real designers write code, always have, always will. You definitely can't argue with Zeldman, right? I've argued with Zeldman a million times. Must a designer write code? I don't know. Is it really essential? Well, this is another quote. This is from Glenn Murphy, who is a UX lead at Google for Chrome. And he says, I don't think it's strictly necessary, but from observing the work of many UI designers, the best tend to be the ones with a non-trivial technical background. Being able to understand the underlying form and structure of the system you are designing for is essential. The best architects and industrial designers deeply understand the materials they work with and use that knowledge to produce amazing work. It's no different in software user experience. So, I mean, the bottom line to me seems to be that it might be possible to design for the web without writing code. In fact, I know people who do it and do a good job. They have valuable contributions, even though they don't know code. But it's probably not possible to be truly, truly great at designing for the web, or really any digital product. I mean, you're talking about apps and other things, too. Probably not going to be truly, truly great unless you understand those materials that you're working with, which is ultimately code. So this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's a quick note for the developers, which there is actually a lot in here. This applies to you, too. Don't think you're getting off the hook. I'm primarily a designer who has sort of learned to code, but this goes the other way, too. You know, I think that you developers, too, have a responsibility to understand a thing or two about design. While I'm speaking from the perspective of designer coding, you know, as I'm talking, hopefully you can sort of flip it around and see how the same thing applies, you know, going the other way. In fact, I have another quote that's sort of along those lines. This is from Rachel Andrew, who is a developer in the UK. She works on a CMS called Perch, a little small CMS, and that's what they call it, is a small CMS. It's really good. She says, I'm a web developer producing things for humans to use and interact with. As such, the whole product, The whole product has to matter to me if I'm to do my job right. So I've made it my business to make sure I have some understanding of basic design principles, to be able to understand where designers I'm working with are coming from, be able to make sensible decisions when I'm left without a creative for some element of the build. So, you know, let me give you an example of that. I know I do this all the time as a designer. Maybe I'm working in Photoshop or whatever, and I'm producing a comp, and I forget things. Like, I forget to include the hover states. Is that developers? Yeah, probably happens to you all the time that designers forget something like that. Yeah. So I do that, and the nice thing is that I do work with a developer who is, you know, has a little bit of design sense. And instead of getting, you know, I send him off the comp, and he writes me back and just says, dude, you forgot the hover states, fix it. Instead, he says, dude, you forgot the hover states. You know, I went ahead and did what I think is appropriate for the mouse over state, and let me know if it doesn't work. And I like that, because I feel like he's stepping up to the plate on you know, him making, being able to make some design decisions, too. Many of the most important design decisions happen in code. And I really do think it's important for developers to also understand a thing or two about design. Okay, but none of this means that you have to wear every hat. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, like, you know, I work, a lot of you guys said you're in-house, and it may be that your job that wouldn't even allow you to code. You know, you're hired as a designer, and even if you wanted to, they wouldn't let you program the back end or whatever. And that's fine. That's fine. I'm not saying that you should develop everything you design or vice versa. But there are good reasons to learn to code, even if it's not your job. First of all, it may get you hired, even if they don't actually need you to write code. I have another quote. I got a lot of quotes. You guys like quotes? I hope so. The thing is quotes are easy as a presenter. I just read them, and I don't have to do any real work. This is from a woman named Brenda Braithwaite, who's a game developer at a company called Loot Drop. And she says, there are many jobs in game design, from system design to narrative design to puzzle design, that don't actually require coding. In fact, I'm just learning to code. But wow, how times have changed. With 30 games behind me, I can get away with this. But if I were fresh out of school, I'd have a shockingly hard time getting hired. I think this is true for web designers, too. In fact, maybe even more so. That there are a lot of jobs in web design that don't require you to code for the job. But you do have to compete with people who have that skill set to get the job. And you may never get hired if you can't do this. So that's point one. Next thing, do you guys know who Jim Kudal is? Jim Kudal runs a design agency in Chicago called Kudal Partners. And he has this sort of mantra that he is always on about, where he says, all things being equal, hire the one who can write. And he's talking about like writing English, you know, paragraphs and sentences and things. I don't think he is actually all that interested in sort of your grammar and your spelling and kind of the syntactical part of writing. I think he's really interested in whether or not the person he's interviewing is able to organize their thoughts and communicate them. And you know, why is he interested in that? Well, because that's what design is all about, is organizing your thoughts and communicating them. And so it's like writing is sort of like an acid test for being able to organize your thoughts and communicate them, which is a big part of what design is all about. And you know, I have a buddy named Wilson Miner, who he worked at he designed every block, and then he worked at Apple for a while, and now he's at a startup called Ardio, the music startup. It's very cool. If you're into music, check out RDIO. Very cool. So he's the head of design there, and I get some of this stuff from him. He's been talking about this topic a lot too, and he likes this rule that Kudal has, but he also has his own variation on it. As he's hiring designers at Ardio, he says, all things being equal, hire the one who can write code. And you know, I think it's a similar deal. I don't think Wilson is actually all that interested in like, well, you know, do they know a particular language? Do they know the syntax? Are they going to get the, you know, are they going to forget a semicolon? I don't think he cares about any of that crap. I think what he's interested in is, can you think logically and systematically and programmatically? Because again, that is important to the field of design. You know, being able to think systematically and design systems. And code, again, is sort of like an acid test for that. If you can write code, you can think in this way. And one second, I've got to get a little bit of water. I talk fast. Okay. So, I mean, ultimately, I think that what Jim Kudal and Wilson Miner know is that being able to code makes you a better designer, even if you never actually have to write code for your job. So I'm going to say that again, because I think this is like really a key point. Being able to code makes you a better designer, even if you never actually write code in your job. All right? Okay. So next kind of topic. The more parts of a project you can influence, the more you can innovate. So I told you guys I was a control freak, and it's true. And I'm also sort of obsessed with innovation. Like, I get quickly bored if I feel like whatever I'm designing has been done a million times before. And what I've learned is that the more parts of a project you can influence, the more you can innovate. So the more control you can exert, ultimately, the more of the end product is going to be innovative and you. It's going to, you know, have more of you in it. Apple knows this. They learned that controlling the entire stack is, you know, a big part of the reason that they're looked upon as an innovative company. I mean, this is why, you know, they didn't just build a music player. They also built the software to go with it and the store and the 30-pin dock connector that lets them control the ecosystem of accessories and things. And, you know, they could have used other people's components and software, but they could have even just assumed that you'd buy your songs elsewhere. But they knew that if they owned all of that, then they would have control, and that would allow them to innovate. And I know it's totally cliche for a designer to talk about Apple, especially at a Microsoft conference. So Microsoft knows this too, sometimes. So take Xbox. I mean, I think anyone would look at the Xbox platform and say Microsoft has been extremely innovative there, right? I mean, the hardware, the games, which, you know, I know Microsoft doesn't produce all the games, but they do have a lot of control and a lot of influence over the games that are produced and how they're produced. You know, Xbox Live, Kinect, all this stuff is really innovative. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Microsoft has a lot of control and influence over the entire product, you know, an ecosystem there. Compare that to PCs. PCs are fine. No, I have no problem with PCs, but I don't think too many people would call Windows PCs innovative. And I think part of the reason for that is that Microsoft doesn't have as much control there. Of course, they control Windows, but they don't control all the hardware OEMs. They don't control the 5,000 video cards and sound cards. And I think ultimately that has held them back from an innovation perspective in that field. But I think Microsoft has really learned that it's important for them to control more. I think you can see that if you look at like Windows Phone 7. They're exerting a lot more control over that ecosystem, and it's very innovative. I love Windows Phone 7. So bottom line, breadth of knowledge, you know, we talk about breadth of knowledge and depth of knowledge, right? Breadth of knowledge, I think, equals influence, right? So the more parts of the project you can influence, the more you're going to be able to innovate. And, you know, that breadth of knowledge just really allows you to see the whole project from a higher vantage point, kind of see everything that's going on rather than just your one little piece of it, even if that one little piece is really all you do in your job. Okay. So how do you get there? So this is the actual practical portion of the talk. So listen up, because I don't do this very often. I don't actually speak practically, so it's important. First of all, just dive in. I mean, this may seem obvious, but if you don't write a lot of code, or if you just write HTML and CSS, which I'm going to get to in a minute, you know, just dive in and play with something else, you know? This is another quote, which I totally admit that I only put in here because it sounds dirty, but find a safe place to tinker by yourself. This is from a guy named Ryan Sims. And I just, you know, it's kind of funny to me, but it's a really well-taken point. Like, just playing around is how we learn, and I think that's, you know, that's what he's getting at here. So first, just dive in. Okay. Second, you're probably not going to learn anything until you need to. At least that's how I am. So I've been wanting to learn how to do iOS development for like 3 years. But I still can't write an iPhone app. And the reason is, like, I've never needed to. I want to, but I've never needed to. Nobody's ever paid me to do it. And there's never been part of a project, so I just haven't done it. So if you really want to learn something, I think the most important thing you can do is find a way to make it a need instead of a want. Find a way to say, I need to learn that in order to do this project. Next thing, don't stop at HTML and CSS. So we said earlier, so a lot of people raise their hand for developers. Let me do this. How many of you guys call yourself front-end developers? A handful. And back-end? More. Both? Even more. Okay, good. So I think there's quite a few designers who know HTML and CSS these days, which is great. And HTML and CSS probably count as code, but they're not programming. So it's a great place to start. And if you don't know HTML and CSS, by all means, start there. That's where you need to start as a designer. But that's not programming, and it doesn't have all the same benefits of the sort of systematic thinking and programmatic thinking and design system thinking that actual programming has. So if you're comfortable with HTML and CSS, but you want to move on. I just think it's really important. And it doesn't really matter, this is sort of the next point, but it doesn't really matter what language you learn. Because again, it's not really doing this, or I'm not really encouraging you to do this so that you can go get a job as a programmer. What's important is that you learn to be able to think this way. Thinking about pattern recognition and problem solving, some of these more high level concepts that are very much related to programming, or that programming encourages. While language doesn't matter, if you want some suggestions, I think a good place to start are the sort of high-level scripting languages that support object-oriented paradigms. So, PHP, Python, Ruby, all very popular. If you're already doing HTML and CSS in your job, probably the single best language you can learn to benefit you is JavaScript. So, that would be another suggestion. I'm skip that. I'll come back to that point. My next thing is, I say, stop having handoffs. So that you know what a handoff is. A handoff is when I say, okay, I've done my part, here it is, now you do your part. Okay, handoffs are where elegance goes to die. I'm convinced of this. Like, that point where you hand the work off is almost always where things go wrong. So I think it's just really important to not have handoffs, but really collaborate, really, folks. Did any of you guys go to Nick Fink's talk yesterday? It was kind of like cross-channel design, a few people. You know who did go to Nick Fink's talk yesterday? Nick Fink, which apparently is an upgrade over last year. Sorry, if you were here, apparently Nick didn't make it to his own session. So, sorry, Nick, if you're out there. Anyway, it was a really good talk on cross-channel, and he was talking about sort of cross-channel design experience, sort of the, keeping a consistent design experience across all these different channels, like from email to packaging to web to retail to all these different channels. And I think that is a big. He's thinking about it in a bigger picture than I'm talking about, but I think it's just the way to get that consistent experience is to collaborate rather than just simply handing off and saying my job's done, now it's your turn. So this is really important to me to really work with the other party. If you're the designer, don't just hand it to the developer and say build it. Or if you're the developer, don't just hand it to the designer and say make it pretty. Sit down and work together and figure out what needs to be done. And because really that these points where design and code intersect, I believe, are the place where the rubber meets the road. Those are the key intersections in the entire product. And if they go wrong, everything is going to go wrong. So let me give you an example. Have you guys seen this site? It's called Pictory. It's PictoryMag.com. And so I worked on this site. I really think it's one of the best design sites anywhere. It's really beautiful. The interactions work great. It's just really well done. And I can say that because I didn't design it. In fact, a print designer designed it. So it's kind of a counterexample to everything I'm talking about. It was designed by Laura Bruno Miner, who happens to be the wife of Wilson Miner, who I mentioned earlier. So apparently this whole talk is coming off like a Miner family love fest, which wasn't intended. She's a print designer. She worked in magazine design a lot. She worked for a magazine called JPEG, and she was the editor-in-chief there. But she doesn't know how to code. She didn't do any code. But what she did do was she worked really, really closely with the developers, which is me and her husband, Wilson, on the project. We worked really, really closely, really, really collaboratively. And ultimately, even though she was not a coder, we were able to come up with a really good web product, not just a print design product on the web. And it did start out as a print design product. She literally sent me InDesign files. It was the first time I ever got InDesign files for a web project. But that's how it started. It's what she knew how to do. But she was just very open to this. She knew that this couldn't be a print product on the web. It needed to really be a product of the web, not just on the web. And so we were able to work really collaboratively together, and I think it came out great. So, the more that you can collaborate, the more that you can work together with your, with the other party, whether you're the designer and talking about the developer, or you're the developer talking about the designer, the more you're going to, really find yourself creating great stuff. I'm going way too fast. I'm realizing as I look at the time that I'm going way too fast. So I hope you guys have lots of questions. Think about them. I'm going to slow down. I'm going to try to slow down. Stop worrying so much about tools and processes, okay? We love in our industry to talk about tools. Tools are cool. Like I said earlier, it's fun to talk. It's fun to read Photoshop tutorials or read about what's new in Expression or Blend or whatever. And it is really important, like I said earlier, to know your tools and know them well. But chances are most of you guys are probably already there. You're probably already really good with your tools. So the next step is, I think, really to start focusing on more advanced design concepts, things like I said earlier, like problem solving, pattern recognition, designing systems. And if you think about it, all those things are very closely related to code. Those are the same kind of things that you do in code. So I just feel like it's a really good way to exercise that part of your mind to write code. The next thing, maybe I can have a little rant on this, but I think we really have sort of blindly drawn this line between the front end and the back end, and nobody did it on purpose, not anybody's fault, but what happened was like I said, there was a point in our industry where we went from generalization. There was the webmaster. This is the way all industries start. There's like a craftsman, like one person doing a thing, and they do the whole thing and they do it well. And then naturally, as industries grow, they start to move into more specialization. And for whatever reason, as we specialized, what really happened was that we broke into this front end and back end thing. This idea that if it's in the browser, it's that person's job, and if it's in the server, it's my job, or vice versa. And That served us well for a while, but let me tell you how I think it got us into trouble. Is, you know, basically what that meant for a long time was that if you're the designer, if you're, you know, the front end guy, it's probably your job to be the designer and to do the HTML and CSS, maybe some Flash or whatever. And if you're the developer, you're working on the back end, and it's your job to you know, write the back end code. And that was fine for a while, but at some point, something came along. JavaScript came along, basically, and I would say ActionScript as well. And these things came along and really kind of made, I think we're in this kind of weird no man's land. So like a few years ago when Ajax sort of took off and became the next big thing, I feel like what happened was that nobody knew whose job it was. I still think this is kind of a problem in our industry, is like, whose job is the JavaScript? Because the designers were like, dude, I don't program. I'm just a designer, and I maybe do a little bit of CSS. I don't know how to do that stuff. And the developers were like, well, that's not my job. It's in the browser. I write back-end code. And I mean, I'm sure not everybody does this. I know there are a lot of people that do JavaScript and do it well. But I still think what happened was that JavaScript kind of ended up in this no man's land because nobody was anticipating that there might need to be actual real programming in the browser. So I think, you know, just we sort of blindly draw these lines. We go like, this is your job and this is my job. And I think we have to be really careful about where we draw these lines. Like, we don't have to draw the line between what's your job and what's mine at the server versus the browser. You know, we can find other places to draw the lines, or we can blur the lines a bit. And it's really about figuring out, you know, what is right for you and in your organization. Okay, last one of these. This is the last practical thing I have, and then I'll go back into the namby-pamby stuff. Beware of the valley of badness. This isn't my phrase. I wish it was. It's from Glenn Murphy, who's the guy I mentioned earlier. That's the UX lead at Chrome. But what he's talking about, the valley of badness, is you guys have probably all had this. We have like a client or a boss that knows like just enough to be dangerous. And you know, that's what he's talking about. He's talking like if you are a designer who doesn't really know how to program and you decide you're going to start learning, just be very aware that for a while you're going to suck. And you're probably going to suck more than you think you do, I guess is what I'm getting at. So, I mean, ultimately, you probably won't know nearly as much as you think you know, and the developers you deal with will know that you don't know nearly as much as you think you know. And they'll be looking at you like, fuck, why couldn't you have just stuck to design? So that's fine, but I think if you're just aware of it, that there's going to be this point where, you know, you might be a little too dangerous. You know, you might be better off just keeping your mouth shut and doing it for yourself for a while before you feel, you know, comfortable really trying to communicate with the developers you're working with. Let me get this a drink real fast. Truly innovative digital products need custom code. Okay, this may sound really obvious, but I don't think it is, because there are still a lot of people doing the thing that I was doing that I was talking about at the very beginning, which is sort of using these off-the-shelf tools and trying to build things with them that they're really not designed for. I mean, there are countless people building all sorts of different things using WordPress, and it works, but let's face it, WordPress was built for blogging, and it's maybe not necessarily the most elegant solution for some of these things that people are kind of shoehorning into that. Just to prove my point, think about your favorite digital products. Like, what are they? Like, shout them out. I mean, Twitter is one of my favorite digital products. What else? Oh, come on. I know you're hungover, but you can. Okay, Facebook. What was that? Surface. Awesome. Yeah. So, what was that? I still didn't hear it. Oh, yeah, totally. So, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of them. There's a million iPhone apps that are cool. There's, you know, you got Flickr, you got Bing, Craigslist, Wikipedia, Pandora, all this stuff. Awesome. Well, now, how many of those that were named were built using some off-the-shelf tool? None. Not a single one, right? And how many of them could have been built with this off-the-shelf tool? Maybe Wikipedia. Maybe. Like, that's it. And so, I mean, again, this may seem obvious, but if you're going to build the next truly great, truly innovative, interesting thing, you're going to need custom code. And this just, I mean, it stands to reason. The whole reason that off-the-shelf products happen is because people have been building like this sort of thing for a while, so somebody says, I'm going to build a product to let people build that thing, and then they'll be able to do it using my product, it'll be easier. So if your idea is really innovative, then it just stands to reason there's probably not some pre-built system that was going to let you build that. Okay, so, and I'll say this too, on the flip side of that, all those products also, none of them also use off-the-shelf design templates. So it's the same thing from the other side. Like, if you're going to need custom code, but you're also going to need custom design. You're not going to just build the next big thing by using some template from Template Monster. Okay, so if you ever plan to build the next big thing, you better know how to code. So I just have a little example from my personal life. Not personal life, professional life. I don't get into stuff from my personal life on stage. You can ask me about it later. It's weird. all right. Finally, you guys are a little bit awake. Okay, so this is a thing I've been working on. It's called Lindle. And it is a site that facilitates the sharing, lending, and borrowing of Kindle books. And this is like, it wasn't my idea. It was actually my cousin's idea. And he called me up in January. And he said, dude, did you know that Kindle books can be lent now? And I said, no, dude, because I don't read. I didn't know that. I've written more books in the last 5 years than I've read. He's like, no, they totally can. And I was like, all right, whatever. And he was like, but here's the thing. You have to know somebody's email address. Like, if you want to send them a Kindle book, you have to know their email address. He's like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a site that basically facilitated the sharing of email addresses so you could kind of go, I want this book. And somebody else could go, well, I have that book, so here's my email address, and we can make it happen. It's really a dating site for people who like to read, basically. I was like, that does sound really cool. It sounds like a good idea. And I just started building. And a month later, we launched it. And then we got shut down by Amazon because they didn't like it. And then The Guardian and The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal wrote about us. And then Amazon relented, and now we're back. It's been really exciting. It's been fun. And the thing is, there's no way I could have done any of this if I couldn't have coded. It wouldn't have happened. I couldn't have afforded to hire a developer. And even if I could have afforded to hire a developer, I don't know if it would have came out the way I wanted. I mean, every bit of this is me, really. I mean, certainly some of it's my cousin's ideas, but every line of code is me. Everything in it is me. And because of that, I love it. I mean, I think it's really good. I mean, I might be biased, but I think it's really good. And that, to me, is just really exciting. And I think that's the bottom line for me. And this is my last quote. And I'm not too bad on time. I'm a little ahead, but it's OK. Hopefully, you'll have some questions. This is a quote from me. And I don't know if it's really douchey to have a quote from you in actual quote, template in your slide. But I did it anyway. I wrote this on a blog post, and it's really the bottom line for me. I want to feel like I have the potential to create the next world-changing web project. Like, I have the power to see my wildest ideas through to fruition. Like, my design work won't ever have to be scaled back in the face of some technical limitation. I don't love programming, but I do love feeling like ultimately I can build whatever I can dream up. And that's why I decided to become a hybrid web designer and developer. Really, that's what I got. I hope you have questions. We got about 20 minutes, so that's not too bad. I was going for 15 minutes of questions, but it's not too bad. We got one. Yeah, if you have them, please come up to the mic. They're recording this, so they want to be able to hear you. Go. Is that mic on? Can we get that mic on?
There we go.
Awesome.
Okay. So I actually run a blog where I try to help designers do things that are a little bit beyond what they are normally used to doing.
Good. That's awesome.
And that's because that was something that I had trouble doing, My question is, where do you start? Because I started with Silverlight, and I started to do backend stuff, and it just completely soup. We've got WCF, and there's OData, and there's a web service. What is a web service? Is RESTful the only web service? I have no idea, that kind of thing. Where do you go to start finding out how to build your thing?
Well, it's a good question. The first thing that I would say, and so the question is ultimately just where do you start? Because there's so much stuff. And I think I did it the wrong way. Because I sort of told you how I got kind of into Django, this framework, and I really learned Django before I learned Python, and I think that's the wrong way. So I think it worked out, but I think the best thing you can do is really just pick a language and learn the language, and then start building tools. I think we have right now we have all these designers who are running around saying they know JavaScript, but they don't really know JavaScript. They know jQuery, and that's cool. It might be all they need to get their job done, but if you really want to learn it, you really want to learn it well. You know, start at the language level, I think, and then once you kind of understand the languages, you can start using some of these tools and frameworks that make them simpler.
I meant a little bit more along the lines of like, do you start with a book? Do you go to a class? Do you start with a project?
What I do, I mean, I do a lot of books, especially the kind of referencey types of books, you know, like the O'Reilly, like Learning Python or whatever. I said I don't read, but I sort of, that's mostly just a joke. I don't read novels. I definitely do books. And then the other thing is I usually don't really dig the tutorials, you know, like the kind of, I just think they're usually kind of so canned that I don't really get that much out of them. And I find myself just sort of copying and pasting the code in the tutorial and not actually learning much. So I try to just come up with a simple project that, like, even if it's never going to launch it or do anything with it, I'm like, I'm going to, you know, build a blog with this, or I'm going to build, you know, whatever it may be, a recipe system or whatever, and just do it. And I think that's, I really think just diving in and building something with it is the best way to do it. Yep. Yeah.
Hi. In our organization, you know, we commonly come into the situation where, you know, designers and developers are fundamentally right-brained and left-brained biologically.
Right.
And, you know, we talk about different ways on, you know, on how to address this and you know, where the hybrid, you know, collaboration comes into play. What are your thoughts on how to reconcile, you know, the differences between how creative people think versus how, you know, technical?
The first thing that you should do is go to Nishant's talk yesterday, or at least find it online or whatever, because he talked a lot about that sort of thing. I don't know if you saw it, but he was here at like 5 o'clock in this room. He talked a lot about the left brain versus right brain thing, and I think, I mean, it's really just all comes down to understanding. It sounds again sort of mamby-pamby or whatever, but it's just, it all comes down to understanding where those people are coming from, and if you have an awareness that the developer you're working with is more of, you know, the left brain type of person, then if you're even just aware of that, then you can deal with it you know, in a professional and productive way, rather than just being like, what the hell, like this guy is so left brain, you know. So I don't know if I have a great answer to that, but I think that just being aware and just trying to be understanding and sort of communicative and collaborative, and just sort of, it sounds so like, you know, whatever, but just loving them for who they are and doing, you know.
I was just curious about your thoughts, because one of the things that we consider is, you know, like the whole nature versus nurture. It's like,
right.
You might have a, you know, predilection towards, you know, one side or the other, but, you know, that doesn't mean you can't learn.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's hard to encourage very well, or it's hard to enforce at an organizational level, but you can encourage it. So I mean, I think, you know, organizations ought to encourage people, and, you know, like you know, everybody talks about like the Google 20% time thing, right? I don't know if that's exactly the model, but it would be cool. And I mean, I've had a few jobs like this where the manager that I had actually sort of set aside some time and said, you know, spend 4 hours a week or whatever just learning something new, and that was like part of my job requirement, and I didn't get, you know, smacked down because he walked into my office and I was like reading a blog post or whatever. So, you know, organizationally, I think if you can just encourage it, then I think that helps. We got one over here, and then I'll go to Snook. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you mentioned how things like WordPress, like trying to shoehorn it, doesn't work. Do you feel that's the way it is for all CMSs, or do you feel that a CMS should be built from the ground up? Because WordPress, yeah, it's definitely built for blogging, but, you know, with like child themes.
Right. Well, first of all, caveat my answer by saying that I haven't really worked with an off-the-shelf CMS for a few years. But my impression is that there are some that are certainly moving more towards being sort of frameworky and letting you. I think, you know, Drupal, I think, is sort of doing this and letting you. You know, they're opening it up so that they are becoming platforms to build more different types of things besides just a blog or whatever. So I think. You know, if you're going to use an off-the-shelf CMS, I think that's one thing to look for, is that sort of flexibility, you know, and finding something that it is extensible and is more of a platform that you can build on rather than just, you know, a blogging system or whatever.
Extensible beyond plugins, you mean, or extensible where you can add your own code?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, it just sort of depends on what you need, I guess. But I write most of my CMSs myself, and I think that that is ultimately there's always a build versus buy thing, right? So there's pros and cons of both. I mean, if you build something, it means you have to maintain it. If you buy something, it means you have to pay for it. If it's open source, you don't have to pay for it, but you may pay for it when you start facing the limitations of it. You know, if you didn't build it, then inevitably you're going to find some limitation, and you're going to be like, I wish it did it this way, but it doesn't. It does it that way. So it's really just a trade-off, and or you just have to figure out what is right for you. Snook, I'm scared of you.
Okay. So admittedly, my question is actually kind of a variation of his. Your advice to everybody here is to avoid off-the-shelf software like WordPress and other...
I don't know if that's really my advice. Okay. But if I said that, I made jokes about them sucking, but there's definitely use case, plenty of opportunity to use them well. But go ahead.
We look at the development stack where, you know, we kind of look at the base language, like Python, JavaScript, C#, and then we have the frameworks that are built on that, like Django, Ruby on Rails, and then we start seeing the software on top of that.
Right.
Do you have a recommendation where users, designers should start? Do they start at the top level and work their way back, or should they start at the bottom of the stack and work their way up?
Well, I think it depends on what you're going for. I mean, most of what I'm trying to get at in this talk is to say that that you can become a better designer by learning some programming. So if that's your goal, if your goal is to become a better designer by learning some programming, then I think you start at the language level. You start lower in the stack, and you learn the language, and then you can build up from there. If your goal is like you've got some client and you've got to build some site by Friday or whatever, then maybe you start at the software level and you say I'm going to use that CMS or whatever. So I think it depends. I think that there are a lot of designers who say they code, but again, it's like what I mean by that is that I can show hide things in jQuery. Okay, that's fine, and that may be what you need to get your job done, but that's not really what I'm talking about when I say you can make yourself a better designer by learning how to code. So hopefully that answers your question. Yeah?
Hi. I don't actually have a question.
Oh, good. Talk away.
Bit of commentary.
We've got 12 minutes. You can use it all for all I care.
I don't have any slides, but... I was trained from the time I was in the fourth grade until I was 22 to be a jazz musician.
Yeah, I was actually a jazz student myself.
And I wasn't good enough to take over the world as I had planned. So I ended up being a software developer because I needed to be very good at something very quickly. And there's someone in the room that I've worked with before who is walking this path of trying to be a hybrid, something that I decided to do about 4 or 5 years ago. Become what some people call a diviner.
Yep.
And this person that's here with me today, he knows that both of us have faced resistance to that.
From organizationally?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Primarily from larger group organizations.
Okay.
Bureaucratic divisions between who does what tend to be a lot more strict. Smaller companies tend to like people who can do everything because they hire less people.
Right.
But I wanted to recommend to everyone who's here today who has these kind of interests that they read a book that changed my life. It's by Daniel Pink, and it's called A Whole New Mind. And to summarize what he indicates in this book, he points out that much of the past has belonged to people who are left-brained, because they built the infrastructure that took all of the analytical capabilities that were required, that the near future belongs to people who are right-brained, who can take all those things that have been built and recombine them in ways that haven't been thought of before. But ultimately, the future belongs to those who can do both, who can learn to use both the left and the brain, right sides of the brain to do things that no one has ever thought of before.
That's awesome.
But I test
so it. Daniel Pink?
Daniel Pink.
Whole New Mind.
Whole New Mind.
Cool. I'm going to check that out for sure. Thanks, man.
Sure.
What was that? Yeah, maybe it's on Lendl. I don't know.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about designers crossing the bridge to get more into development. What about the other direction? How would you recommend a developer who's looking to get more involved in design jump into it? Photoshop's pretty pricey to kind of
Yep.
pick up
so,
and start playing with.
So I would not just say buy Photoshop, because again, that's more of the tools. And I think what's more important, because it's like the same thing. If it sort of like goes to Jonathan's question, if your goal as a developer understanding something about design is to become a better developer by understanding some things about design, then and not your goal is to design a lot of things, then I think the best thing to do is to study the basics of graphic design, typography, color, layout, that sort of stuff, which is not even specific to the web or to digital products. Now, if you really want to get into digital products and you like studying interaction design and stuff like that, I think is great. I think that that's more beneficial for a developer than knowing Photoshop or knowing CSS, I think. It just kind of depends on what your goal is. Like, if you want to do it because you want to be able to do something, you want to be able to build something entirely yourself, and you want to design it and develop it, then obviously you are going to have to know those tools. When it comes to tools, I just don't really care that much. Like, I don't care if you use Photoshop or GIMP or Expression or just whatever. Whatever, I don't care. It's the product that matters, the end product that matters. So, Photoshop is expensive. It's also bloated and kind of my nightmare, but I use it every day. But there are open source tools. There are things, I'm a Mac user, so maybe I don't have as many Windows suggestions, but there is like a product called Acorn on Mac that is an image editor that's like $30 or something. You can get into those tools for a reasonable price. There's also BitTorrent. Oh, I didn't say Adobe. I did not say that. I'm just joking.
He took my question.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you anyway.
Yeah. So a friend of mine is a developer, and the tip I gave him, who asked the same question as these two guys, is CSS and at font face are capable of a lot. As a developer, use that and learn design with those tools.
Yeah. That works.
So understanding that, of course, you can't force anybody to do anything they don't want to do.
Right.
And also considering that most of us are select representatives coming from our company and
right.
going back to hopefully bestow knowledge.
Yep.
What would be your suggestion other than just showing them the video of this session?
Well, that would be the best thing.
trying to convince certain people to explore being more hybrid. I'm sure you can sympathize with designers saying I'm like scared of coding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is to me, like, I think this is why it's really important for them to understand the point that being able to do some code is going to make you a better designer. Like, so it's not about, it's just, I think the way you appeal to them is not about like, dude, I want you to learn some code because I'm having to do all the work. I think the way you appeal to them is more like, if you put a little time into this, you will actually be a better designer. Even if you never write any code, it will make you a better designer. And if they're passionate about design, that might appeal to them. So I think appealing to them in that way a little bit, this is what some of the other people were talking about, right brain, left brain. You have to understand that the designer is the right brain person who does respond to that sort of emotional, like, passion sort of argument more so than a developer who maybe is more left brain and responds a little bit more to a logical sort of argument. So I don't know. Yeah, hopefully that helps. I don't know. Let's go over here real fast and then I'll come back.
So I just wanted to ask, you brought up the valley of badness idea.
Yes.
So I'm curious where you think that line actually is, because I was sitting over there thinking, and if the title of this were reversed, and if mm-hmm. it's developers becoming designers,
right.
you'd probably have a much different reaction to it overall, just because of who designers are. So where do you think, logistically, if you're making that transition in an organization where you are part of a team and you are collaborating, where's that line where you kind of don't become, the DB in the room who's off trying to,
right.
take away what other people are good at?
Well, I think the line is probably really hard to define, but I mean, that's why, I think the point I was trying to make there was really just to be aware of it. I just think if you're aware of it, I was that DB, when I got into code, I spent like an evening like doing a Django tutorial and then like immediately went to work the next day and was like, all right guys, I know Django, so do it this way, like you're doing it wrong. and that didn't go over so well. So I mean that, you know, it's just mostly just about being aware of that. Like, but as far as where that line actually is, I mean, you definitely have to respect what somebody's role is. I mean, I think that's that's really the key. Like, you know, even though I still am primarily a designer, still do mostly design work. And I try to like, when you know, doing design as a person who can code affects my design decisions, and I oftentimes have something I want to communicate to the developer when I'm you know, showing them my comp or whatever. Like, so here's what I was thinking. You know, we could have a database, and it would have these rows or these tables or whatever. I think that's fine to like sort of throw that out there, but at the same time, it's really important that you trust, you respect that that's really their job. It's like, here's kind of what I was thinking, and if they say, well, I was, you know, that's cool, but we should do it NoSQL and we should do it this way, fine, you're the developer, you know, like, you do it. So I know this isn't really answering your question, but I just think that's really just about respecting people's roles. And you know, it's about thinking of it more as a collaboration, especially in organizations. I mean, if you're just building something yourself, that's different. But if you're in organizations, you're working with other people, and trying to respect their roles, but at the same time collaborate and work together on things. So, yep, over here, we got 5 more minutes.
All right, I'll be quick. There was an article last year from Cameron Chapman, she wrote in Smashing Magazine, about there was going to be less need for designers and developers, and she said the big driving force behind that was mobile. Because with mobile, design's important, but if someone is on a website, that means they want information right there.
Right.
In other words, you know, content is king.
Right.
So, in the case of, do you think that mobile is the reason for the hybrid? Is it forcing it more? Was it always there? Or is mobile...
I think mobile is kind of forcing us in a lot of directions, but they're almost all directions that we should have been going down anyway. Like, you know, we have always been thinking about the web, you know, as sort of a desktop-centric thing, and mobile, even when mobile kind of came along, it was like, oh, we'll also do mobile. But really, you know, we should be thinking of the web as this you know, thing that could potentially be used on any sort of device, anywhere, or any kind of context. And so, again, I'm giving a big conceptual abstract answer instead of a practical answer, but that's what I do. That's why I said I don't really have practical tips. I think that there is some mobile is driving some hybridization, but I don't really believe that. I believe that we probably should have always been doing that, and the mobile is just like it's bringing to light some of the problems that we've always had. So, let's go over here and then back to you, and then that'll probably be it.
Okay. So let's say you've got a designer and he's starting to learn some stuff. Where do you actually fit him into some sort of work process? And the reason for that is because a lot of times a designer will start to do something, he'll get kind of good at it, and then either he's doing it all the time on the side project until he gets good enough to suddenly be in a new role, in a position. Like, how would you ease him in to it so that he can get better at doing that bit of code that he's starting to work on?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that I think that designers, really not just designers, everybody, I think everybody needs to be involved in the project from the very beginning. And obviously not everybody can be in every meeting, and most people wouldn't even want to be in every meeting. But I think it's important that that you know, your designer, for example, hears some of the conversations and has an understanding of, like, you know, what is going on in the back end. Like, what are the decisions you guys are making? You know, why did the developers decide to use this database instead of that database, or this tool instead of that tool? And I think if they're just around for those conversations, they're going to start to, it's just going to all start to make sense to them a bit. And they'll probably sort of naturally start to gravitate towards things that sort of speak to them and say, you know, I could maybe help you guys with that, or I could, you know, maybe I have an idea on that. And designers, by nature, what we do is solve problems. And I mean, I'm biased because I'm a designer, but I believe that we often get brought into the projects way too late. That you know, like, a lot of decisions are made, a lot of things are built, and then it's like, oh, here, designer, and it's like, and for me, a lot of times it's like, man, if I wish I had been involved earlier, because I might have said, like, what if we did it this way? You know, and I'm sure developers have the exact same thought, because it's sort of organizationally, some organizations sort of work development up. So, you know, they build cool stuff and then they add a design to it, and other organizations kind of go the other way, where they design stuff and then they build it. So I'm sure it happens both ways, but I really think in either case, the more you can get people involved at the beginning, everybody kind of involved, however they can be, the better off you'll be. So, One more. Hi.
Hi. Mine's not so much of a...
Turn that down a little bit. I can't hear you. Yeah.
Mine's not so much of a question as much as a summary comment. I actually give a design for developers talk to user groups in my area. And I get that question a lot. And just like in your slide, you had the only way to learn code is to code a lot.
Right.
I don't think any developer would say, oh, well, the first time I wrote it, it was perfect.
Yep.
And I get a lot of people that want me to look at their designs and or their, excuse me, their applications and help with the design. And they already have it the way that they want it done.
Right.
Done. And I think that's what I wanted to say is you would never write it one time and push it out. You're going to troubleshoot it. And designers go through the exact same process.
Right. Iterative. Right.
And you were saying, somebody had asked, like, how developer could really get in on the project. Make a personal project, and then make it again in a totally different style. I suggest you actually make it in an absolutely hideous style that is the worst style you could possibly get to, just so you get into that valley of badness so you know where it is. Animated GIFs, Comic Sans, go for it. Just so you can actually, you know, poke around in what's going on there. Because really, until you start iterating, you wouldn't always troubleshoot your code. Designers go through the same thing, and I think with iteration, that's really where you get to learn how to be the hybrid. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you. So that's it. Go make cool shit.